You're listening to The Caring Economy with Toby Usnick, sponsored by Philanthropic Impact.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Wherever you are in the world, welcome back to The Caring Economy with me, Toby Usnick. I'm really excited now that we're in our fourth year and our 13th season to be going from strength to strength. Today we have as our guest a really celebrated purpose-driven leader. Her name is Maryam Banakaram. She is a purpose-driven change agent. She's a catalyst, a brand builder, a community leader. Maryam has led marketing transformation at some of the world's most iconic brands, including Hyatt, Gannett, NBC Universal, and Univision. She's also the co-founder of NYC Next, which we'll talk about today, a grassroots volunteer movement aimed at supporting New York's artist community and revitalizing this city that we love so dearly. Maryam is a passionate advocate for the power of business to do good, as am I, as everyone on this show knows. She believes that companies can be a force for positive change in the world, and she's committed to helping them achieve that purpose. So welcome to The Caring Economy, Maryam.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be with you.
I have to say, it is Halloween today, and I was just remarking at your son's backdrop there. It's so superpower, and I think it's probably a good metaphor for you as sort of this catalytic change agent. So why don't you give us, as we always ask our guests, give us a 2-3-minute, 4-minute overview of your life story, where you were raised, how you found your way, pivots along the way, any sort of special mentors or moments?
So I'm originally from Iran. I was born in Iran. I went to preschool in Boston for a very short period and then went back to Iran where I was in school until fifth grade. 1979, the revolution happens. There's a lot of turmoil, obviously, as you can imagine. And after my father had been under house arrest for a while, and then we heard he was going to be blacklisted, we ended up leaving the country thinking that it was going to be temporary, but obviously things turned out to be not temporary. So I ended up doing my sixth grade year in Paris while I think we were still waiting to see what was going to happen. And then when it was clear things were permanent, we moved to a suburb of San Francisco's where I went for junior high school and whatnot. And then I came to New York to go to college here at Barnard College. I say New York is the city that gave me my voice. It's also the place that I felt like I belonged for the first time after having sort of lost my community, along the way, given the revolution in Iran. I think New York, because it is such a diverse community and because there is sort of this energy and the sense that anybody can make it, right? There's sort of this incredible energy and world of possibility. For me, it was home. And I think it was home because I joke, there's one of every eight people here. Like you can find your people here if you are so inclined. And I was always searching for my people in some way, right? And your people don't have to necessarily be people who were from your country. They just have to be of the same mindset. And so I've been in New York pretty much ever since. I mean, I've had a little stint, Argentina, London, Paris, Chicago, but and a little bit of high school in Newport Beach. So I've covered a lot of ground, but I have made my home here in New York City.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by the Iran background. I've been impressed with the Persian diaspora through the years that I know. And I wonder, is it fair to say that it is a very connected community and that you are sort of in sync with everything that's going on in the world, or is it sort of disparate?
I don't think so. You know, that's so interesting. I think that, my parents moved us to Northern California, to San Francisco, so not LA. Mm-hmm. And there weren't a lot of Iranians in my, new hometown of Lafayette, California. So I didn't really grow up around a lot of Iranians. I mean, yes, my parents had some Iranian friends and we saw them, but we really matriculated. Mm-hmm. I think that if I had gone to school, in Great Neck or in Beverly Hills, it might have been a different experience. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting, I used to joke when I was at Univision that all good Iranians should work in Spanish language TV. I was really impressed by the Hispanic community. Yeah. And how they were able to move from sort of, obviously if you're Mexican, you have differences from Cubans and whatnot. But when the Hispanic community really began to coalesce was when they recognized the power of being a block mm-hmm. in some way. I don't think Iranians really are good at that yet. Mm-hmm. I think that in the whole aftermath of George Floyd, the Black community became much more coalesced. I also think after there was so much hate around Asian Americans, AAPI has come together in a way that has been really kind of amazing to watch, right? I think Iranians still have not managed to do that. Now, it's interesting. This is not something I've studied, so, you know, take this with a grain of salt. Yeah. But I think that one of the things is, you know, are you a collective or are you an individual? And I think that that's often the struggle when, you know, groups want to come together, but then also, you know, struggle with sort of that, you know, giving up a bit of themselves in that process. Mm-hmm. And so I think what was amazing for me to see was in the Woman Life Freedom Movement that, you know, happened obviously after the unfortunate killing of Mahsa Amini, you saw Iranians come together, I think in a way that you had not seen before. I would say, you know, when we moved here in the middle of the hostage crisis, we didn't hide that we were Iranian, but, you know, people weren't leaning into their identity as, sure. You know, there's a lot of obvious prejudice that was around. I remember distinctly meeting a kid who told me that for the first time, and he's younger, that he felt proud of being Iranian and less like an axis of evil. And he hadn't really felt that way, especially after 9/11, right? So not to say that it's one and the same, but, you know, people brush people by the same stroke sometimes just out of not knowing. But right. But I think in that moment of Woman Life Freedom, you also saw like the splintering begin to happen as it went on for a longer period of time. So, you know, to me, the cohesion comes when you can get through those splintered moments and remain together. I think that's still hard for the Iranian community.
Yeah. The government right now is, you know, being blamed for much of what's going on in Gaza, but there's also amazing people there, right? I've been trying for several years to go to Iran to visit on a cultural tour because there's so much, as you well know, there's so much history and culture there. And I've not been able to get a visa, but I still believe at the people-to-people level is where we can kind of keep things moving forward in a peaceful way.
Separating people from their governments is always an important distinction. Those are not always the same thing. You know, you don't have to go all the way to the Middle East. You can look here. There are times where our government is not reflective of all of our opinions. And right. I think that's today sort of more and more the norm, where there are forces that are constantly trying to divide us, either intentionally or unintentionally. Mm-hmm. And this sort of goes back to, I think, what you and I have in common, which is that we believe in like a solution that's based on humanity, right? Being able to sit across from somebody and share a meal, yeah. Almost simple acts of kindness that can add up by just mm-hmm. getting people to sit together and recognize each other, you know, without all that artifice.
Yeah, and finding the common ground, which we're all capable of doing. I talk a lot on this show about bridging leadership. I think that's where we need to go more because, as you pointed out, government, media, forces tend to push us aside right now, these days. But I'm optimistic long-term, and I know you are. Before we get to NYC next, I want to just hear about the early, we'll say sort of the corporate day. So you find yourself in these major corporations. Like, how did this little girl who left Iran during a crisis stopping in Paris and then making it to California. How did that all happen?
You know, I ended up going to, I was fortunate. I got into Barnard College. I like to tell everybody I got in off the wait list, which is the truth, partly because, you know, it's not always on the first try that things work out, and they sometimes don't work out at all. Right. But mm-hmm. turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to me. Just had a lot of energy. And upon landing here at Barnard College, I joined every club I possibly was interested in. I really was willing to lean in and get involved. And I wasn't overly concerned about being cool. And I think, again, I was always trying to rebuild community. So I would connect all my communities to each other. I didn't have sort of like these friends that I didn't introduce to these friends. To me, it was all just one big group. Mm-hmm. And so I think coming out of college, well, I sort of took a job as a paralegal for a couple months as a way to make money. I moved to Argentina. I was sort of looking to see if I would end up becoming a journalist. Long story short, I end up at business school, but I did a joint degree with the International Affairs School because really I had studied political science and my heart was probably more in that. Mm-hmm. But it led me to sort of the circuitous path of going into marketing really by accident, in the sense that I was too young really to be in business school in retrospect, but there I was. And everybody sort of came in knowing the kind of job they wanted when they came out. For me, I was there to learn. So that was a pretty big disconnect. And I did a project really, when I was in college, I did a column, and it was a travel column of being an insider when you landed in a city, which makes sense when you think about my search for belonging around the world. Mm-hmm. And The Gap had done this campaign called Individuals of Style. I sort of somehow had this idea of combining their campaign with my travel column, and I pitched it. Nothing had come of it. I'd sort of mocked it up. It was on my shelf, and a friend from business school saw it and said, you know, you should send this to Mickey Drexler. He's the president of The Gap. He's really accessible. This was internet. So I put it in the mail and sent it to him, and it was finals, and he called. And I joke with Mickey Drexler all the time that he started my career, because while he wanted to know if I wanted a job at The Gap, I was just focused on trying to make the book. But he then had Susan Cooper, his head of recruiting, call me. And she said to me, you know, this is a marketing idea. You should consider going into marketing. And long story short, that's exactly what ends up happening.
I love it.
And, you know, I literally was that kid who didn't know what to do with herself. So I went into career services and did one of those bubble tests that told you what you should do. And one of the things it said was account executive and advertising. And I, you know, was not a kid who grew up with, you know, lots of contacts and, you know, networks that came sort of by birth, if you would. So I applied to the one advertising job that came onto campus, Y&R, and that's how I started. I started my job as an account executive at Young and Rubicam.
And what was Mickey like to work with? He's so infamous with his, I know he used to have like the speakers in the office, and he would tell people what's on his mind. And before there
was, you know, he was exactly as he's described. He's very authentic in the sense that, you know, you get what you see. He was amazing. And it's funny, I actually had that phone call with him. He was incredibly generous and said to me, he was asking about some of the places I've written about in San Francisco. And I said, oh, well, I'm going to be home in a couple of weeks. And so I actually invited me. I went out to see him in his amazing offices overlooking the bay. And then I lost touch, right? I mean, I wasn't looking to work at The Gap. I didn't end up going to work at The Gap. But then when I heard that he was, you know, when he was sort of summarily leaving The Gap, I actually found a way to reach back out, and I thanked him. I said, thank you so much. Really, I sort of told him the story about how he'd really gotten me going, because sometimes I think people are very good at remembering people on their way up and not really remembering them in other times. And for me, really, he'd been seminal, and I don't think he knew that at the time, but he does now, because we stay in touch. I stay in touch with both Mickey and Susan Cooper, who was his head of HR, who had reached out to me.
That is awesome. I love that story. I mean, we do want to always be going upward in life, but sometimes you'll also be going down. And it's, as that old saying is, be kind to people on the way up, because you're going to see them on the way down. So
there's always ups and downs, that I can guarantee you.
Yeah. So take us to a sort of a quick sort of Candyland tour of your brands that you worked for, because you were really involved with so many of them.
Yeah, so I did Y&R, so that was early days. And at Y&R, I worked on lots of different accounts, from People Magazine to Clear Blue and Clear Plan, which were family planning brands, you know, Xerox, and even the Today Sponge, which was an episode of Seinfeld. So, you know, I got a good breath. And Jiffic and Senka, I forgot. I mean, they really rotated us through. And then I ended up leaving Y&R to go to Turner Broadcasting. Somebody who'd been at Y&R went to Turner Broadcasting, and that's how I ended up going there. I always loved storytelling. That was, you know, I wanted to be a journalist. I think stories were sort of always important to me. And then I went from Turner to the very early days of the internet to City Search, which goes back to sort of my wanting to be an insider and sort of knowing where to go. And then I went from City Search, from the fastest part of the internet to the slowest, which was Macmillan Book Publishing, where I was a book publisher. And then I left Macmillan to go to Amirati at a very small group. It's not even on my resume. And it was just that department was just a shit show. And so I ended up leaving. They shut down that group, but I ended up leaving. It was like sort of this incredible moment of like, okay, now what am I going to do? Because people didn't switch jobs quite the way they do now when I was coming up. And I had taken a night class while I was at that job at FIT on accessory making. I made the ugliest belts and bags known to mankind. But in the process, met a woman who'd been in the bag business, and we started a bag company. We made diaper bags, pet carriers, and computer bags. It was all functional bags that you could make fashionable. And actually, our first client, which I landed, was Barney's. So, you know, there was something in this.
Yeah, yeah.
But then she got into business school and was like, I'm leaving. And I was like, wait a second, what is happening? And she said, oh, you can be in business with my mom. And I was like, really, what is happening to me? So she left. I was like, I'm good. She left. And I kept, you know, we sort of split up the intellectual property. Like, you do bags, I do bags. Like, okay, we're good. But it started me taking on consulting projects because I had to get new labels for the bags, which were coming from China at the time. So it was like 8 and 8 week lag. So all of a sudden I started getting consulting projects, and it was like the consulting was a cash cow. And I was sort of like, you know, shipping bags on the side. And by this point I was also pregnant. So, you know, I was like a pregnant lady running around the streets of the garment districts, getting like skins of leather and whatever else. And also then spending 3 days a week consulting to make cash. And I ended up doing this for 5 years. I did it for 5 years. There was always something in the bag business, but I learned I didn't really want to be in business by myself. I actually needed people. And so when I got a call, really as a favor, to take a meeting at Univision, I took the meeting and they offered me a job. And I'd been doing consulting for, at this point, for big periods of time. And so I said to them, like, okay, we'll agree to a 1 year contract. And I went in and ended up staying 7. So that's how I pivot back into Univision, NBC Universal, Gannett, Hyatt Hotels, and then taking a break and then doing Next Door.
Yeah. But always the storytelling, which is so core to you and also to me, right? Like, how do you tell a story that's compelling, concise, and then how do you land it and make sure that it's meaningful, not just to you, but to larger population? So take us then, give us a sort of the launch into NYC Next. Maybe tell us a little bit about what it is and then how it came to be.
Well, I took the job at Next Door 3 weeks before the pandemic. So you can imagine that was a big shocker. You know, and I went from having my last job before that was a big corporate job to like a tech startup. And so I was at Next Door. Next Door became your lifeline in the middle of COVID. You know, our daily active users were through the roof that February. And then, you know, as you, we all remember, Black Lives Matter happened. If you were a social platform of any kind, that was the time you never saw the day, you know, the light of day. But in that all, we were here in New York City in our neighborhood of Chelsea, and all the articles started coming out about New York being dead. And I remember one day saying to my husband, like, let's try and help the thing that's right here in front of us instead of something bigger. And I sent an email to a handful of friends saying, I don't know what to do, but I want to do something. You guys are all smart. Like, who's willing to get on a phone? And by the time we got on that first phone call, the group had ballooned because it was the height of COVID. We were all home. Nobody was really going anywhere. You couldn't have FOMO. There was no activity to be feeling like you were missing out on. And so we quickly dreamed up the idea of doing moments of joy that were not trying to draw crowds because it was the height of COVID, but that we could take and amplify on social and earn media as a way to tell the world that New York wasn't dead. And our goal was really to support our artist community. I really believe that the arts are the soul of New York City. And so whatever money we raised from friends and family, we paid a stipend to the artists, and everybody else donated their time and resources, from Gary Vayner over the course of New York City Next to Edelman to, you know, a lawyer who helped us get a SAG waiver. It just went on and on and on. And it was really an incredible experience of, you can have purpose and impact when you come together and go so much further. And also in doing that, not only find your own community, but build community. Mm-hmm. And New York City Next was sort of an incredibly glorious project, which I was doing on the side, like many other people, as I was, you know, trying to help take Next Door public in the middle of, you know, a pandemic. So, there's no rest for the weary.
What are some of the examples of what one would experience with NYC Next? Was it, you said, you know, it was smaller in focus because of the nature of the pandemic, but.
Well, we did our first pop-up right here in Chelsea. We actually got Ilio Villafranco, who's a Grammy award-winning musician, and he brought a couple of people, and they did sort of like a quartet on the corner. They were going to do it right in front of our house, but then we pulled it to the corner so that there was energy being given to the open air restaurants. And then they basically put on a very short concert because you're trying not to draw crowds. And we videotaped it and captured it and pushed it on social. That was sort of our test and learn moment. The second one we did was a moment for Broadway. We managed to get the red steps of Times Square at a time where the city wasn't giving out any permits. And we had Bernadette Peters and 24 Broadway performers sing Sunday and from Sunday in the Park with George. Sondheim gave us the rights. Tom Kitt, Michael McElroy, they brought that song to life with amazing, amazing, talented Broadway singers. And it was really an incredibly moving moment because they hadn't been together since the world had shut down in March. So we've gone from March to October. This was the first time they were using their voices out loud in unison, and everybody had face shields and masks, and, you know, and everybody was crying. I mean, it was really an incredibly moving experience. So that really put us on the map because, as you can imagine, that sort of blew up. And we ended up doing 14 pop-ups in different neighborhoods and boroughs of Manhattan, all working with within the community, from the Metropolitan Chorus singing on the steps of the Metropolitan Museum to working with Salvation Army and the Black Surfers Association and Far Rockaway. You know, you name it, we did it. And it was a side hustle. So we sort of, everybody was squeezing it in and making it work. And then as the world began to open up, we were like, how else can we help? Because at this point, the governor's office had started sort of a pop-up concert idea that was quite similar, which was great. It was like, you know, we all need to come together to help the city. And that's when we dreamed up New York State of Mind. And Tom Kitt really was able to get Billy Joel to grant us the rights to New York State of Mind. And we made a music video that really is an ultimate love letter to New York City with iconic New Yorkers and iconic locations, thanks to Josh, who filmed it. And again, everybody did it for free, and we managed somehow to get a SAG waiver, which was unheard of. And it got 2.5 billion impressions, like, pretty quickly.
Brilliant. And
then the next year won an Emmy. Like, you know, you just never know what comes your way. And none of us was doing it for any of those reasons, right? I think for all of us, we, you know, I think Jennifer said we found purpose out of despair, which was really the truth, because it was a way to have some control and some output at a time where we were all sort of frozen in place.
I love that. And you did say billion, not million, 2 billion?
Billion, 2.5 billion impressions. The last we counted, which was we stopped counting, you know, when the rights ran out a long time ago.
Amazing. Ladies and gentlemen, again today on The Caring Economy, we have with us Maryam Banekarim. She is a change agent, as you're seeing and hearing, and a brand builder and community leader. Maryam, so what are you working on now?
So, I mean, that effort, you know, after Nextdoor went public and the New York City Next project really sort of took hold, I was asked if I would leave my job to come and help New York City. And that's when Kathy Wilde convinced me to join forces with the Partnership for New York and dream up a campaign for the city, which is what the We Love New York City campaign was, which launched in March of last year, right? So I've been working on that, but on the side, because, you know, I always seem to somehow have a side hustle all the time. Here in Chelsea, we live on what is now considered an open street, which is really a closed street to traffic for certain hours to try and give people more space to walk with distance. I had seen this picture of people having a meal together on the street, which what I now know is iftar in Egypt. I had no idea it was really just a picture. And I posted it on my Nextdoor and said, wouldn't it be amazing if we had... we sat together with the neighbors we've gotten to know and the ones we don't know at a table like this. And I got lots of reactions. It also connected me to eight neighbors I didn't know. And we hacked together our first longest table last year, renting tables and chairs and inviting neighbors to come with friends and food. Last year, we had 500 people showed up. This past October 1st, we had over 700 people show up. So as I roll off of the We Love New York City campaign and pass that baton on, because, you know, it's been... you can only run at things at that speed for so long. I think I'm now interested in sort of this hyper-local, community-driven way to gather. And I think the things that bring us together are the arts, are food. It can be sports. I'm less of a sports person, so I'm going to stick to the arts and probably food.
Yeah, I love that. In your experience in storytelling and consensus building, can you say a little bit about intergenerational? We hear how people are going to pull their hair out because Gen Zs and millennials are just not getting it. And, you know, maybe don't do eye contact or take phone calls, or all they want to do is text. I don't think that's the case, but I wonder how you succeed at storytelling, landing your messages intergenerationally in times that can be sometimes quite challenging.
You know, I mean, I joke that I was a millennial before my time because I had like 50 jobs at a time where that wasn't a thing in my generation. Look, I'm obsessed with sort of intergenerational relations today because I feel like there is this incredible divide between those of us who didn't grow up digitally native and those that did, right? And even socially native. And I try to reserve judgment. I just find it so easy to be like, they're lazy. You know what? That's not how I just think that's the wrong way to approach it. And so for me, I just think that they have seen and experienced a world differently than us, right? They've had way more tumult than we did. It's not so much that the world wasn't complicated before. We just didn't have access to see it and experience it on our phones 24/7 the way they do now, right? So they look at us and say, I don't want to be you, or I don't want to bring a child into this world. Like, those are things I hear from Gen Z, and not just my own kids. I actually happen to have gone to a Gen Z conference thrown by Gen Z. And what I found interesting was how many of them had side hustles, how many of them were content creators. Some of them wanted to go into the corporate world. Some of them wanted to be entrepreneurs, but mainly what they wanted was a seat at the table, because they look at the generations, you know, that are older and say, the world is a mess. So like, you didn't solve all the problems, so hand over the mic to me.
Yeah.
And so I think the thing I'm most interested in is, how do you draw the wisdom from the things we've seen without alienating the youth where they think that we know better? Because we don't. And how do they learn so that they don't have to repeat some of the mistakes that we made, where we can be open to new ideas and equations from them, and also their energy? I mean, the truth is that they have a longer runway. And, you know, I don't think that we have to like fall over to hand the baton. I think, you know, I go back to the corporate world. There's a reason we set succession plans for our senior executives. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things you do as a board. You make sure that there's a succession plan. Don't wait for the succession plan to be like when that person can't, you know, walk. Right. Give them the runway. Part of it is, you know, coaching people so that they can take the baton sooner and you can go do something else. It doesn't mean you have to retire. There's plenty of ways to be useful.
Yeah. Do you have any sort of quick tips for people who might want to be able to take a page out of your playbook? Like, when you hear this, do this, or maybe ask this of someone to get to know.
I would say, be curious and genuinely interested in learning. I mean, I met a young woman, he's a Instagrammer on my block. And I went out to my network and I said, who wants to learn a little bit more about how to use their Instagram? And I hosted 20 people and Andy gave them tips. Yeah. I mean, you just have to be willing to get out of your comfort zone. And I know many marketers who have other people posting for them. You know, that's fine. I force myself to use TikTok or, you know, to edit reels, which I'm sure would be much easier for somebody else, partly because it's muscle memory, right? And so when you ask people to do things, you know what it takes to do it. The first time I used TikTok, I was at Next Door. I was like, whoa. I mean, seeing how that product functioned, how easy it was to pull in music into the edit, like those were just amazing things, right? A couple of weeks ago, I had the good fortune of being a guest editor at Fortune, and they asked me to moderate an AI panel on the main stage. It was terrifying. I know nothing about AI. You know, I'm very thin. And I was very upfront. I was like, this is not my area of expertise. They said, no, we think you'll make it digestible to the audience because not everyone will be an expert either. It required my getting over the fear. It required my studying for 3 weeks. And when I got to the other side, like I was so much smarter than I was before. And it was sort of like forcing me to have to, you know, cram and learn. I think be curious, right? Be genuinely curious and willing to listen and learn. It doesn't matter if they're older, they're younger, they're different than you. That's kind of the beauty.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about AI and you scooped my question, but I do think that it's thrilling. We are really in the year of AI, and I think people have preconceived notions or are just put off by it. But I love nothing more than getting people in front of it and showing them the potential that it has for so much good. Can there be downside? Of course. But I think the point is we all need to be actively engaged with it to help shape where it's going to be used and how it's going to be used. Otherwise, all bets are off. Would you agree?
Well, I think people like to do things that are familiar and the unknown is scary. That's what AI feels like to most people. Even I intellectually understood that it was important and it was hard to wrap my arms around it or make the time to go do it. That's just the deal. And that's partly why I said yes when they asked me, even though my first instinct was to run away, you know, like the house was on fire. AI is here. It's not that it's coming, it's here. That's what I would tell you. Like a year ago, there would have been a couple of companies. Now, like everybody's an AI company. So I think that, again, I think we lived through the internet. We lived through the unintended consequences that came up with that. When I was moderating this panel with somebody from, DeepMind and Google AI and Anthropic, that was sort of the conversation, which is, what are the lessons we learned from that experience that we can apply today so that we can make different kinds of decisions, knowing that, yes, we can't stop innovation, but there's a way to do this in a more ethical way to try and deal with the humanity that also is necessary as part of this equation. Yeah. So the great news is I think that there is a sense that, you know, that's possible. There are definitely people who recognize that it's important. Now, I think it's on all of us to get involved so that we can try and understand the levers to make sure that that happens. On the flip side, I think I listened to a very interesting podcast as I was trying to get smart, which was called Bot Love, like B-O-T Love. And it's two reporters who have been following communities who actually have virtual companions. So remember that movie Her, where just imagine that on steroids. And that is another area that you don't read about as much, right? But here, I mean, there are people who've been doing that. And it was fascinating because, you know, I listened to these stories and people are less depressed. They're like, at least somebody's asking me how I'm doing in the morning, even though it might be Siri. Like, it seems, a little bit wonky. And yet I think it's a very human way to digest what the possibilities and maybe even existential questions are around AI. So I think, you know, like anything else, it's like force yourself to dig in and not be left behind.
You know, I have taught a couple courses in AI for social impact, and I'm very much learning as I go, but I love it. But what I learned last week, I finished reading Walter Isaacson's new book on Elon Musk, and we hear so much about Elon Musk. I did not know that he was one of the co-founders of OpenAI with Sam Bankman. And then they had, and it was a reaction to Google. I think it was Larry Page, but one of the Google owners who said that he differed with Elon. So Elon wanted to have the open source model, and then Google was going to do what they would do. But I had no idea. And the reason he's driven to do that, according to this book by Isaacson, is that he is committed to ensuring the continuation of human consciousness, which I thought was pretty interesting because he wants tech and AI, but he wants to make sure humans are still, that human consciousness is still amazing. And I was blown away by that.
So it was also interesting because Anthropic is a group of people who worked on OpenAI who left to now start their own AI that's based on constitutional AI that actually has like a constitution that's, you know, values and ethics based as part of the model. So I think what you're going to see is lots of different iterations based on people's experiences and areas where they disagree or think that there's different ways at it. I think, look, to me, in the end, like, you need technology. Technology is here to stay. That is not going away. And the question is, how do you enable more humanity using technology, not technology as an end itself? I think it's complicated. I think, this idea of growth at any cost, which, you know, works well if you're in the VC world and you're trying to, you know, cash the check. I think we all understand that there's ways to have growth, right? You go back to purpose, the way Jim Collins defines it. I'm not talking about being a nonprofit, and that's not what I'm talking about. I think there's a way to make profit and do it in a way that's conscious. And, you know, we all love to use Patagonia as an example. It's a good one. Like, there are different ways to actually solve this problem if we are interested in applying ourselves and pushing ourselves not to just go the easy route. Is it complicated? Yes. Is it worth it? Yeah, I would think so.
One last question. It's going to go back to midway through the interview. Catherine Wild, the Partnership for New York. I'm in awe of her. I think she's an amazing leader. And I wonder if you share that sentiment, if you might just reflect on her style of leadership and what the partnership does, because a lot of people don't know how important the partnership is.
Well, I don't think, nobody should talk for Kathy or the partnership, but Kathy. So, there is that. I mean, I think what was interesting me to learn, and she's obviously formidable and, you know, often referred to as the most powerful woman in New York. I think what was interesting to me is how in the 1970s, when New York had a difficult time, Felix Rohatyn and David Rockefeller came together and rescued the city by actually getting involved, right? Doing the Teddy Roosevelt, like getting in the arena. In their getting involved, they ended up setting up the Partnership for New York to ensure that the business community had a way to engage and also stay in the arena. Kathy's been there since the very beginning, I think becoming the executive director, you know, a little while after it launched. I think it's an amazing thing, but there's so many other things that have come since the 1970s. I think the bigger question I have is, like, is that civic mindedness that existed in the 1960s in the US at the era of Kennedy, where they said, you know, ask not what you can do for what your country can do for you, you know, the saying, does that still exist today? Where I think, you know, you read Bob Putnam or some of, you know, David Brooks or Arthur Brooks or whoever, I think that we move towards becoming much more of a society focused on the individual. I can do this. I can move my company because it's easier. All my things are in the cloud. To this place gave me so much. How am I going to give back to it? Right. And so whether it's the Partnership for New York, whether it's government organizations, whether it's citizens, I to me, you need all of those things. The problems are bigger and more complex. Mm-hmm. And so whether I do it by organizing neighbors via longest table or a marketing campaign or a fund or, you know, a way to coalesce business leaders so that they can actually have a voice and take on sort of a responsibility to make the world better. It doesn't matter. It's like find one way that works for you and step in, whatever that way is that works for you.
I love that. Mariam Banakaram, thank you so much for joining us on the Caring Economy today. Mariam is that purpose-driven leader we've just heard from today. She is a change agent. She's a catalyst. And I can't wait to see what happens next. Maybe I'll get invited to your table next year.
There is no waiting to be invited. It's on the street. Everyone is invited. And that's awesome. The magic of the table.
Awesome. And I share your love of our adopted hometown. I love the city and do anything for it. So thank you for sharing your story with us today.
Toby, I'm thinking you need to organize a longest table and I'll give you the toolkit. Like, this is how we multiply.
I love a challenge. To be continued.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to The Caring Economy with Toby Usnick. Please share your comments and questions with Toby via Twitter at TUsnick or LinkedIn at Toby Usnick. And thank you for sharing The Caring Economy with your friends and colleagues.